Even voices start to say in that as well. So this has become a grassroots movement which will influence everything. And the first result you can see of that, the election of the Honorable George Galloway as a member of the parliament in Britain, he came to the platform on for Gaza and was elected for that. And this movement will become bigger and bigger and bigger, and it will change a lot of the ruling elite. You're not going to see their faces again in offices. I hope so.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to cut you off right there, but we're running out of time. Mr. Masoud Shajari, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, and also Mr. Saeb Shaath, author and a West Asia expert from Belfast. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس النَّاسِ وَإِثْمُهُمَا أَكْبَرُ مِنْ نَفْعِهِمَا وَيَسْأَلُونَكَ مَاذَا يُنْفِقُونَ قُلِ الْعَفْوَ كَذَلِكَ يُبَيِّنُ اللَّهُ لَكُمُ الْآيَاتِ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَفَكَّرُونَ ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
As Israel's genocidal war enters its 164th day, Doctors Without Borders says that the situation in Gaza is catastrophic and words cannot describe it. Tensions in the Korean Peninsula, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea launches multiple ballistic missiles as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits neighboring South Korea for talks. And Russia's President Putin warns the West against sending troops to Ukraine, saying that it could take the world to the brink of World War III. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The Gaza Strip is enduring relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling as more Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh attacks. The regime has targeted several areas near the southern city of Khan Yunis. They include Hamad Town, where five dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble. Israeli warplanes also struck some neighborhoods in Gaza City and its vicinity. The regime shelled east of the Beraj refugee camp and targeted homes in the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza as well. That led to the killing of several Palestinians. Israel unleashed its war in Gaza in early October. Over 31,600 Palestinians have been killed so far. The war rages on while Gazans are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid severe food shortages. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says people in the coastal sliver are on the brink of famine. Doctors Without Borders also say that the current situation in Gaza is catastrophic and indescribable. The senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the group is waiting for a response to a ceasefire proposal from Israel and the U.S., the regime's main accomplice of the Gaza genocide. Osama Hamdan said the initiative put forward by Hamas is a realistic one with clear details. He said that it provides for a swap of captives in Gaza and Palestinian abductees and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Hamdan said the Palestinian movement had, during negotiations, called for an end to the war, the return of refugees, the dispatch of aid to Gaza, and the start of the reconstruction of the Strip. Hamdan touched upon the divisions within the Israeli regime on the war and added that Tel Aviv has achieved none of its declared objectives despite the atrocities committed in Gaza. He said that Hamas has told intermediaries that acts of aggression against Gaza must stop. Israel has launched a fresh operation against Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa Hospital, which is sheltering tens of thousands of Palestinians displaced by the regime's onslaught. Witnesses in Gaza City say tanks surround the hospital site and nearby areas have been bombed. Gaza's health ministry says it has received information that shows that there are dozens of casualties. The Hamas resistance movement has called the storming of Al-Shifa Hospital a war crime. The Israeli military has carried out multiple operations in and around medical facilities across the Gaza Strip since the start of its genocide on October 7. According to the UN, 155 health facilities in the Gaza Strip have been damaged since then. The Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has called for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying that Palestinians need the Israeli bombs to stop. Varadkar said that Gazans desperately need food, medicine, and shelter. He also said Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that is unfolding for their eyes in Gaza. The Premier also called on the U.S. to secure a truce and to create space for lasting peace. He made the comments during a meeting with the U.S. President at the White House. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has also raised the alarm over the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the territory.
We are all extremely concerned about the war in Gaza and the unfolding catastrophic humanitarian situation. Gaza is facing famine, and we cannot accept this. It is critical to achieve an agreement on a ceasefire rapidly now that frees the hostages and allows more humanitarian aid to reach Gaza.
Von der Leyen also voiced concern about Israel's threat for a full-scale offensive in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. She said that it would have a devastating impact on the civilian population. She made the comments in a joint presser with the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo. Sisi also opposed any Israeli ground operation in Rafah that would further deteriorate the humanitarian crisis. He also underlined Egypt's opposition to any Israeli attempt to forcibly displace Palestinians from their homes. People in different countries across the globe continue to voice solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. In the Netherlands capital, hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrators gathered outside of the National Holocaust Museum for the second time since last week. The demonstration came as a delegation from the Israeli regime was visiting the National Holocaust Museum. Protesters held pictures of the children killed in Israeli bombings in Gaza. They called for an immediate end to the ongoing genocidal war in the besieged strip. In another European capital, London, people displayed their support for the Palestinians during a rally against racism. They called for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Also in Italy, hundreds of protesters gathered in Milan in support of Palestinians. The demonstrators held signs reading "Stop the genocide in Gaza" and "Stop arming Israel." The German city of Berlin was also the scene of a massive rally.
We are here to demonstrate for Palestine, and I think it's not only about Palestine here, it's also about showing our anger towards the German media and the German politicians, because they have a lot of power and they decided to take a side. And even they use sometimes some wars for a human crisis or something like this. I can't believe it. I have the feeling that it's just an empty wars.
The protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They carried blood-stained small mock body bags, reference to the large number of children killed in Gaza. In Bahrain, which has normalized ties with Israel, protesters hailed the Palestinian resistance fighters and decried the U.S. for the Israeli bloodletting in Gaza. Also in Chile, in South America, a massive rally was held in the capital, Santiago, with protesters denouncing Israel for the killing of over 16,000 children in Gaza. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched multiple short-range ballistic missiles amid growing tensions in the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said it detected the launches early Monday. It says the missiles flew around 300 kilometers before coming down on the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. The new development comes as the U.S. Secretary of State is in South Korea for talks. Washington and Seoul wrapped up their latest joint war games last week. Pyongyang considers such drills rehearsals for invasion. In Russia, near-final results of the presidential election show the incumbent Vladimir Putin is on course for another six-year term in office. According to Russia's Central Election Commission, Putin has garnered over 87% of the vote, with with over 95% of the ballots counted. None of the three other candidates has reached even 5%. Vote counting began minutes after polls closed on Sunday across the country, as well as in four Ukrainian regions annexed by Russia in 2022. For the first time, the election took place for 3 days, starting from Friday. Election officials say the nationwide turnout was over 74%. This is the eighth presidential election in Russia and the fifth term for Putin if he is declared winner. Well, Vladimir Putin has issued a warning to the West over the Ukraine war shortly after the early results of Russia's presidential election showed that he would remain in power. Putin says the presence of Western troops in Ukraine can put the world on the verge of World War III.
I think that anything is possible in the modern world, but I've already said this and it is clear to everyone that this conflict between Russia and NATO will be just one step away from a full-scale World War III. I don't think anybody is interested in this. NATO military are present there in Ukraine. There's nothing good in this. Firstly for them, because they get killed in large numbers.
Putin also touched upon peace talks with Ukraine. He expressed Russia's readiness for talks on a French proposal for a ceasefire during this summer's Olympic Games. However, Putin said that he will take into account Russia's interests on the front line of the war. The president added that Russian armed forces hold the initiative on the battlefield as they have made advances in Ukraine. On Saturday, the French president said that his country will ask Moscow to observe a ceasefire in Ukraine during the Olympic Games, where Russian athletes are banned to compete under the country's flag. For the third year in a row, Afghanistan has been declared the least happy country in the world. That's according to the UN's World Happiness Report. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
President Joe Biden and the former President Donald Trump continue to move toward a rematch in November after clinching their party's presidential nominations. Both nominees have been exchanging jabs as campaigning intensifies. To discuss that further, earlier we were joined by our guests in our news review program.
Time now for the news review. Stay tuned. The U.S. President Joe Biden warning that freedom and democracy is under attack, and that after former President Donald Trump suggested a bloodbath in the case of losing the fall election. Biden was speaking at the Gridiron Club dinner, which was packed with journalists and politicians. He said Trump's lies about a 2020 election, the plot to overturn it, and to embrace the January 6 attack on the Capitol have posed the greatest threat to America's democracy. President Joe Biden's campaign also stated that Trump wants another January 6 to happen. On Saturday, Republican nominee for U.S. President Donald Trump said if he does not win the fall election, America will never have another election.
If I get elected, now if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. If this election isn't won, I'm not sure that you'll ever have another election in this country. Does that make sense? I don't think you're going to have another election in this country. If we don't win this election, I don't think you're going to have another election, or certainly not an election that's meaningful. And we better get out, or we better...
Now, Trump was addressing a gathering of GOP supporters in Ohio, urging the people to vote for him in the November presidential election. He lashed out at his Democratic rival and incumbent President Biden, saying that he has destroyed America's economy. He said Americans will not enjoy proper Social Security, medical, and other welfare services with Biden in office. Campaigning has intensified in recent weeks, with Trump and Biden attacking each other's record and character. Okay, now let me invite a couple of academics from the U.S. to get their insight on this. So joining me is Daniel Shah. He is an academic and commentator out of New York. And Saeed Khan is also an associate professor with Wayne State University. He's joining us from Detroit. Daniel, what do you expect would happen on the election day in terms of the results? Would that Capitol Hill thing be repeated again or something like it?
Right now, every poll indicates that there's no confidence in Joe Biden. About 84% of the populace thinks that he is indeed senile. A lot of people don't necessarily trust Trump. They're just so disgusted with the Democrats, with the corruption. So another slogan that I heard from out where Saeed is, I'm in New York City, but having just returned from the Midwest, many people are saying, well, throw away this clown, but don't throw away the burgers. In other words, throw away Trump. But Trump's base, which is indeed backward, extremely anti-immigrant, extremely pro-war in many cases, but they're angry. And they know that they can't trust the swamp and they can't trust Washington, D.C. So how do we work with these workers who are disgruntled? They've suffered through the opioid epidemic. Washington has completely forgotten about them. And how much of the industry in Cleveland and in Flint and Detroit and Chicago has been abandoned, how many working class families are suffering, and they'll never vote for the Democrats. They have zero faith in the Democrats. So here comes Trump with his rhetoric, and Trump has really been able to manipulate people into thinking that he's somehow on their side. He's a billionaire worth $4 billion who could never relate to the common man in any way. And just to point out that there are other independent candidates, there's Dr. Cornel West, there's Claudia de la Cruz, there's Jill Stein, but the system is rigged. It's not a democracy. It's a dictatorship of the rich, and they make sure that none of those third-party candidates are actually viable.
Okay, Saeed, we got 1 minute. Let me know what you predict would come out of this election in 6 months' time almost. From now,
I think it's right now far too early to and premature to predict what's going to happen. There's a lot of moving parts here. There is some notion that Democrats who are currently disgruntled with Biden, who, as Daniel said, don't have much faith in him, may come back to him because they see Trump as an existential threat, the GOP as an existential threat, whereas Biden being and the Democrats being more of a strategic threat. Some of this is going to play out regarding Gaza. I think a lot of it is now going to play out regarding TikTok. If Biden signs a bill that then bans TikTok, he's going to lose an entire generation of people, as was said before. And that's game over for the Democrats. So right now, it's really going to be a vote by negativity. Who does somebody want to see less in office? And again, there's just simply too much time between now and November for things to happen where we're not able to predict that.
Okay, fair enough. All right, thank you so much for the insight. Daniel Shaw in New York, Saeed Khan in Detroit.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him, or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Years, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulama that are Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Dear listeners, in the seventh episode of this Ramadan series, we are going to focus on Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran. This ayah is about insight and deep realization of religion and requirements of time and age. Stay tuned, please. The days of the blessed month of Ramadan are the best opportunity to contemplate on ourselves and the philosophy and meaning of life with regards to the circumstances of modern world. Definitely, improvement and perfection in every human aspect requires full awareness and information on the path to move in. God says in Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, "Certainly insights have come to you from your Lord, so whoever sees, it is to the benefit of his own soul, and whoever remains blind, it is to its detriment." Some of the great lexicographers of Arabic language believe that the word basirat, insight, is the belief of heart in a religious issue or a reality. Some others have described it as smartness and admonition. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "Indeed, an insightful person is he who hears and thinks, looks and attains foresight, then is admonished, so moves in the clear path and avoids falling in precipice." If one is insightful, he will be able to see near and far in warrens, just as we should be careful not to fall in precipices and traps in spiritual and social affairs too. We have to take care not to be deceived or go astray. Once a man called Ishaq ibn Ammar came to the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, and told him, "I have a neighbor who performs prayer a lot, helps the needy, and goes on Hajj pilgrimage very much. I have not seen any wrong from him. What kind of person is he in your opinion?" Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, asked him, "How is his insight?" The man answered, "He's not that aware and has no insight in religion." The Imam answered instantly, "So he will not gain high rank with these worships either." An insightful person can recognize various currents and encounter them vigilantly. He can discern the plots of enemies and choose his duty towards them. God says in the Quran that faith is the most important factor to attain insight. Insight is the means to differentiate between good and evil, between right and wrong. God-wariness strengthens insight and helps the person to act smartly and wakefully. He will thwart the plots of enemies. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had an exemplary insight due to his God-wariness. When he was on exile in Nofello Chateau, in the outskirts of Paris, he would not accept private meetings with various personalities, saying, "We have no private place." He used to hold meetings with several persons to witness the whole meeting so that no word would be decreased or increased to the talks. This is what today is happening through compound war and media war. This is called media literacy and considered as a part of insight. Therefore, insight is like having eye in confrontation of various events. Masoud Rajavi, head of the MKO terrorist grouplet, asked for a meeting with Ayatollah Beheshti, who was the judiciary chief in early 1980s. Ayatollah Beheshti accepted his request. Rajavi announced in a meeting that the MKO members were ready to pay allegiance with Ayatollah Beheshti, provided that he accepts their conditions. Martyr Beheshti told him, "Our difference with you is not a superficial difference. It is rather a deep difference originated in basic beliefs. My argument for you is that you don't even know Marxism." Then he read out part of Karl Marx's book, Capital, German, and translated it. He said to Rajavi, "If you refer to the original German book, you will notice that there are many fundamental mistakes in definition of Marx's economy. You have mixed principles under with the name of Islamic economy and Marxist economy and have found your ideology on this basis. This, while you should have recognized, acted, promoted, and explicated Islam according to its own principles." This very erroneous perception of Islam caused MKO terrorists to murder over 17,000 innocent people in terrorist operations, most of whom were ordinary men, women, and children. One of the most indelible stains in the MKO record was the terrorist blast in which Ayatollah Beheshti and over 70 of the companions of Imam Khomeini were martyred. The more one reflects on the ayahs of the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the more he or she will gain insight and the power to analyze events and conditions. We are duty-bound to think deeply on various events and affairs. This will help us to come to a clear conclusion instead of being trapped in hollow and poor analyses. Weak analysis has been the pitfall of many societies and personalities throughout history. Zulkela was among the companions of Imam Ali, peace upon him, but owing to lack of insight, he was deviated and joined Muawiyah's camp and then became one of his commanders. Although he was fighting in front of falsehood, he thought that he was struggling for God and defending truth. Seeing the Prophet's loyal companion, Ammar Yasir, Zulkela remembered the words of the Prophet when he said, "Ammar will be killed by a rebellious lot." This was going to shake him and that of the many of the deceived forces in Muawiyah's camp as they could see Ammar on the other side. When Muawiyah noticed this hesitation among his camp, he immediately answered Zulkela, "Who knows whether Ammar will stay with Ali and not join us?" Lack of insight and deep ignorance caused Zulkela to be convinced and stay with the rebel, Muawiyah. He was killed. Ammar was martyred after him to clarify the truthfulness of the Prophet and rightfulness of Imam Ali and his companions. Muawiyah was happy as Zulkela was killed before Ammar because he knew well that had he seen Ammar's martyrdom, half of the Muawiyah's troops would have joined Imam Ali. This is ignorance and stupidity which extinguishes the light of insight.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be highlighting how Zionist weaponization of anti-Semitism is beginning to spectacularly backfire. In November last year, one prominent Zionist zealot made a preposterous accusation of anti-Semitism about a student's mascot on the University Challenge TV quiz show. But she was left with a copious quantity of egg on her face after legal action was taken by the student who was targeted. As Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
According to Baroness Jacqueline Foster, a blue octopus is one of the most disgusting anti-Semitic symbols. She claimed this in a grovelling apology she was forced to make by Rahman Lowe, the law firm acting for British Muslim student Malika Georgiani. Foster had taken to X, formerly Twitter, in November 2023 to denounce Georgiana, a contestant on the BBC quiz show University Challenge. She singled out Miss Georgiana as being responsible for the team mascot, a blue octopus, which Foster described as being one of the most disgusting anti-Semitic symbols, and for wearing the colours of the Palestinian flag. She called for Miss Georgiana to be expelled by her university and arrested by the police, tagging in the Prime Minister, Home Secretary, Ofcom, the BBC and Oxford University. In fact, Georgiana was in a team of four which had collectively picked the octopus, as it was one of their favourite animals. The jacket worn by Miss Georgiana on the show was navy, blue, orange, pink and green. Malika Georgiana received death threats and abuse after Baroness Foster smeared her. Foster recently apologised, saying, "I wrongfully alleged that Miss Georgiana chose a blue octopus as her team's mascot, which I held her responsible for. I accept that these allegations were completely false and unfounded. I made a grave mistake in making those posts, and I should not have done so." Naturally, prior to making her racist comments, the Baroness had been on a lobby trip in May 2023 to occupied Palestine, with flights and accommodation paid for by Zionist group Elnet UK. Elnet UK was set up by Joan Ryan, famous for inventing anti-Semitic slurs against Labour Party members, as exposed in the lobby, and by Paul Charney, a former tank commander for the genocidal occupation forces. Foster is also on the senior advisory board of the Drone Delivery Group Limited, a lobby group for the drone industry. As is well known, the occupation forces in Palestine are increasingly making use of drones to more effectively commit genocide in Gaza. But in the end, is a blue octopus actually an anti-Semitic trope? In fact, blue octopi are regularly used by Jewish groups in a positive way, as in this children's book on Oscar the Octopus, and in other examples. Zionist propaganda is increasingly overreaching and overheating. More and more people are becoming instinctively resistant to it. It remains to be seen how long it will continue to be deployed to any effect by the Zionists.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm pleased to welcome back Steve Headley as our guest contributor today, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Steve is a lifelong socialist and trade unionist who was the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the RMT Trade Union until quite recently. He's also been an anti-racist pro-Palestinian activist all his adult life. His book, Derry Boy, was published in January and quickly sold out at his book launch at the Bookmarks Bookshop in central London. Welcome to the show. David, why on earth do these senior politicians believe these fairy tales? I like the idea that the blue octopus is got some inherent anti-Jewish meaning. It's absolutely preposterous, isn't it?
Well, it is preposterous, and we should treat it with the derision it deserves. It doesn't deserve any proper analysis. It's just a joke. I mean, these people are just jokers. But the people who believe it are people who either are paid-up Zionists or have been convinced by paid-up Zionists that this is the case. And the Zionists will give them pictures of octopus, like this lovely Hanukkah octopus Oscar here.
Yes.
And they will say, actually, this was used by the Nazis, and therefore any representation of a blue octopus must be anti-Semitic, except, of course, the ones which are not anti-Semitic. And it's used quite widely in Jewish folklore, in Hanukkah illustrations, as a pro-Jewish thing. So it's completely ridiculous, and it's used just to weaponize anything that can be weaponized against those who criticize Zionism.
Yeah. Well, I started by asking Steve about the hysteria being generated to vilify opposition to the Gaza genocide, like the ludicrous complaints against the University Challenge students' mascot and jacket.
Well, I mean, it's quite obvious to anybody with a brain cell why she was targeted, and that's because of her ethnicity. I mean, she was a brown person, and brown people are anything they wear can be interpreted, it seems these days, as either in support of Palestine or as somehow anti-Semitic. And I think that this is an agenda for all the Zionists to try to close down any debate and any criticism, to frighten people, to freeze people in the submission. And I think it's backfiring. It's backfiring badly because people are not being intimidated. They're out in the streets. And the people are wearing Palestinian colours very proudly.
David, Latifa's report there said that Baroness Foster's involved with this obscure British Israel lobby group, Elnet. What more can you tell us about them?
So Elnet is a European leadership network, and it was set up in Brussels. It's been one of the key Brussels Israel lobby groups for some years now, but they recently set up a British branch, which is created by Joan Ryan, who famously, yeah. From the lobby programme, famously indeed. Invented anti-Semitic abuse against her. Yeah. And of
former
course, by
Labour
this
MP, of course.
Former Labour MP. And of course, this guy called Charney, who's been involved in a whole range of Zionist organisations, former IDF tank commander. And his function is, as with all Israel lobby groups, is to radicalise and propagandise decision makers, and of course that's why they've taken decision makers from Parliament to occupied Palestine, including this woman who went on a trip last year, I think it was.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's what these organisations are for. They're there to make sure that decision makers in the House of Lords or the House of Commons, who are not already signed up to Zionism, can be turned to become fanatical pro-Zionists.
Right. Well, the young woman on the University Challenge was singled out specifically because was visibly Muslim. So I asked Steve for his thoughts on this deeply disturbing trend in Zionist messaging.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think the Zionists weren't expecting the absolute backlash to the genocide in Gaza. Not only Muslims, but 70%, over 70% of the British population, the entire British population, regardless of religion or ethnicity, want to stop to this genocide. They want an immediate ceasefire. But the people that the Zionists are targeting in order to build a profile of somehow violent or extreme elements is the Muslim population, and it's completely untrue. I mean, I've personally been on every demonstration. I've seen very, very little violence at all. The main violence that I saw was from members of the English Defence League who had been summoned to a counter demonstration by Tommy Robinson, but by and large, their marches have passed off without incident. So again, I think their strategy has been ineffective.
Well, as I was saying, David, I mean, you know, the Zionist lobby's really lost the plot on this one, haven't they? I mean, you know, Latifa's report highlighted that the Blue Octopus, and I think you were just making the point, actually, is actually a Jewish-friendly image. I mean, how much more ridiculous can these characters get?
Well, they've overreached, right? They overreached in this case where they lost the libel action. And actually, the solicitors who took the case for this young Muslim student were the same solicitors who won my case in the tribunal. So, you know, Zilla from Zillerama and Zach Samur from 11KBW. So they've taken this case and they've shown that actually you can't just say any old nonsense about people and expect to get away with it. So they've won in this case. Now, in examples like this, here's another happy blue octopus. This is an image from a garment which is being sold on Amazon. Not in any sense anti-Semitic, obviously. But yet, nevertheless, whenever they can try and find a way to, however circuitously, to link a particular image to anti-Jewish hatred, they will take it because, of course, they are desperate to find ways to criticise and to destroy those of us who are pro-Palestinian because that's what's happening. They're creating genocide in Gaza, and they have to find a way to fight back.
And particularly targeting Muslims, as we've seen. Well, I then asked Steve about Baroness Foster's involvement in the deadly drone industry and what that tells us about the values of many of those who are currently engaged in British public life.
Well, I think when we've got Zionists and admitted Zionists who are in lobby groups with Israel, and are also members of the House of Lords or Baronesses, and they're involved in drones that are being used to kill people in Palestine, innocent people in Palestine. We have to ask, who is running politics in this country? Have we got a foreign country in the shape of Israel? interfering in politics in this country. We have to look at the Israeli lobby and who they're funding in Parliament, in the House of Lords and in the House of Commons. Because if this was Russian influence, for example, there would be a whole hue and cry about it. There would be an investigation. But it seems to be just be accepted that the Israeli lobby can sponsor MPs, giving them huge sums of money, foster lords and give them huge sums of money, and absolutely nothing is said.
Well, it's time for our next report now, and then we'll come back to the discussion. This one outlines some of the other farcical examples of Zionist hyperbole.
Hissing is now apparently anti-Semitic too. On the 29th of February, the latest Zionist overreach claimed that hissing at a council meeting in Newham, East London, was an act of anti-Semitism, since snakes, which are among those creatures that hiss, have been used in anti-Jewish propaganda. Three socialist activists were later arrested at midnight for racial harassment under the Public Order Act in a shameful misuse of police time and resources. They deny any hissing. The councillor, Josh Garfield, denounced the alleged hissing as an attempt to bully him out of public life as a result of his ethnicity. The pathetic level of the victimhood is astonishing. The alleged hissing is audible for no more than 3 seconds, and then there's Garfield's response.
If members in the gallery want to hiss me, they might wish to speak to my face about the issues they have. But, Chair, I won't accept it.
I'm going to adjourn the meeting for 15 minutes.
Garfield is, of course, a card-carrying Zionist, being a member of the National Executive of the Racist Jewish Labour Movement, which is formally affiliated to the Zionist movement. The mayor of Newham, Roxana Fayaz, who is a Muslim, issued a strong statement the next day, nonsensically referring to anti-Semitic abuse. Across the ages, tropes like the use of snakes have been used to fuel stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination against Jewish people. Why would Fayaz say that? Maybe it was her attendance the day before the council session at the annual dinner of the Community Security Trust, the group which runs point for the genocidal Zionist regime. In a speech at the council meeting before the alleged incident, she specifically raised comments by the Prime Minister there about the alleged increase in violence and intimidation against elected representatives.
Last night, I was with members of the Jewish community over at the Community Security Trust event in central London. The Prime Minister was there, and he did speak about something that resonated with me. He spoke about the significant increase in violence and intimidatory behaviour being faced by elected representatives.
Alternatively, part of the reason might be the advisory role in a Zionist lobby group, the European Institute for the Study of Contemporary Antisemitism. Among the directors of EISCA were Chairman Stephen Pollard, who later presided over a record-breaking run of falsehood at the Jewish Chronicle, Jeremy Newmark, later disgraced in a scandal over missing cash from the Jewish Leadership Council, and Dennis McShane, a former Labour MP jailed for expenses fraud. Among the other members of the advisory board were a who's who of Islamophobes and or extremist Zionists, including Michael Wine of the Community Security Trust. Back in 2009, EICSA were denounced as a dubious body involved in the sad politicizing of anti-Semitism by Tony Lehrman, the leading authority on the political uses of anti-Semitism. The trope bandwagon will continue rolling until it's brought to a halt by a collective refusal to take seriously the genocidal nonsense spouted by Zionists.
Well, Steve was an eyewitness to the so-called Newham Snakegate rumpus, so I asked him to describe what happened and what the atmosphere was like when the Zionist councillor claimed that he'd been subjected to anti-Semitic hissing.
Yeah, well, first of all, we went as members of the Trades Council, the Trade Union Council down in Newham to oppose £17 million worth of cuts to the budget, which would meant destroying the special educational needs budget, redundancies, and the decimation of services right across Newham. So everybody from the Labour Party who went up to defend the cuts got heckled. I mean, there were a few choice comments made. Now, this so-called hissing, I didn't hear it. On the night, I didn't hear it. I was sitting right beside one of the persons accused and right behind one of the other persons accused. I was sitting about 4 paces or 5 paces from the third person who was accused. And I will tell you now, absolutely none of them hissed whatsoever. They did not hiss. But the atmosphere in the place was, critical of the Labour Party. Then we had the mayor, Roxana Fiaz, who opened the meeting by giving a statement of how she'd met Rishi Sunak and how her and Rishi Sunak were completely opposed to intimidating political opponents, and we can't have people criticised. We can't have politicians criticised in a way that would upset them. And she kind of set the scene for this guy who came on called Garfield. And he came up to the rostrum and he turned around and said, can people stop hissing behind my back? We all looked at each other and went, what's he on about? No one's hissing. Certainly we couldn't hear any hissing from where we were sitting. And then the chair of the meeting shut the meeting down. And somehow this hissing that I couldn't hear was interpreted as anti-Semitic in some way. Now, I have no idea how this interpretation was reached. I didn't even know the guy's name at the time. I didn't know his religion. I didn't know anything about him. But even if people were hissing, why would it be anti-Semitic? I mean, couldn't it just be like the Barry coming on in a program, in a theatre even? When people would hiss, he's about to make £17 million worth of cuts. Maybe people would have hissed. How would they know his religion? How would they possibly know his religion? And I think it's a sort of trope that can be turned the other way. Why would people hiss at Jewish people? I don't understand it. And what is that trope all about? So the atmosphere that night, I believe, was, if you like, a setup. I think people reacted at the first opportunity to anything that they could interpret as anti-Semitic and used it to try and sully the name of not only the trade union protesters but the independent councillors that were present as well.
Well, David, I mean, do we know if this councillor Garfield character has ever been involved in any phony anti-Semitism incidents in the past?
Oh, yes, indeed, Chris, we do. He's been involved in all sorts of phony anti-Semitism incidents in the past. He was a participant in the Panorama programme, Is Labour Anti-Semitic?, when he couldn't even come up with an anti-Semitic allegation. He said that he was sometimes called a dirty Zionist, as if that was in some way anti-Jewish. And, of course, he's previously denounced Momentum in the local area as being anti-Semitic, without producing any evidence. He has a long, long history of this. If you go back to some years before that, he's, of course, been involved with radicalising young kids in Zionist summer camps and the usual sorts of connections that these kind of people have. He's in the Jewish Labour Movement, yeah, on the national executive of that organisation. So, yeah, he's making a career. He's not even 30, and he's making a career of fake anti-Semitism allegations.
Right. Well, I then asked Steve about the background of the three socialists who were targeted in this incident.
Yeah, there are three members of our Trades Council. There are three active trade unionists. I think they're also members of the Palestinian Solidarity Committee, but that's not the reason that they were there that night. So why they would think that it was those three particular people and not anybody else. I mean, I wasn't cautioned for hissing or had the police coming around my house to say that it was hissing, and I was sitting right beside one of them. So how could they distinguish it from being him and not me? It made this alleged hissing noise. It's just bizarre. It doesn't make sense. So I think, again, there's an element of people who have been active on the issue of Palestine, active in opposing the genocide, have been singled out because of their political activities, and they're trying to be silenced.
David, the elected mayor in Newham's got some history with Islamophobic Zionist lobby groups, doesn't she?
She has. I mean, she has been involved for a long time in the area of extremism and radicalisation, and she was involved with this anti-Muslim, anti-Semitism group where she was on the advisory board. Then she became the chief executive officer of an interfaith group dedicated to undermining Muslim opposition to British imperialism and to wars. And then she was, after that, the chief executive of another organization, which is run by a guy who is a personal friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. So right. She has a long history of involvement with Zionism and with Zionist interfaith groups. So it's not surprising that she would make this kind of statement, which she made in Newham, to back up Garfield's nonsense about snakes.
I also asked Steve whether he thought the police were targeting these pro-Palestine activists, or whether the mayor was to blame, and whether he thought this was a colossal waste of police time.
I think that the names of these individuals were given to the police by the councillors in the hall, or perhaps the mayor. I don't know which of them did it, perhaps both. But there's no way that the police would have known who these people were if the Labour councillors and the mayor hadn't pointed them out. And I can reiterate, and I will go to court and swear this, I heard no hissing whatsoever, and certainly there was no hissing coming from the person beside me, the person in front of me, or the person just off to my left. I just think we're in a very dangerous time where the opposition to the war in Gaza is growing in strength. And I think that the government and the Labour Party want to defuse that opposition. And I think that there's no lie or slander that they won't use in order to make out that people are somehow violent or anti-Semitic or otherwise behaving improperly. And, you know, it's just not true. And Labour have to understand that their policy is very unpopular. The government's policy is very unpopular. Most Labour supporters, the vast majority of Labour supporters, want a ceasefire now, and Labour are not delivering that. And they will pay. They will pay at the ballot box. People will not vote for them. And I hope that people will vote for candidates that are demanding peace in Palestine.
David, what would you advise people who are caught up in these Orwellian situations like this?
What happens when people are caught up in these situations usually is that they are surprised by what's happened because, of course, they've not done anything wrong. They're usually anti-racists. Indeed. They've not been anti-Semitic. And they don't understand that this is something serious. And they sort of think that it can go away, or you can try and discuss it with people and it'll be fine. But it won't be fine. This is an all-out attack, in this case, on people from the left. But usually it's on people who are Palestinian or Arab or Muslim of origin, and they deliberately target Muslims for this kind of activity. You need to get advice swiftly. Don't speak to anyone else until you've got advice, preferably from a lawyer, but from comrades, trusted people who you know, who understand these kinds of things. Don't take the